Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This episode sponsored by We Feed Raw. Most dog food was built for convenience and shelf life, not for dogs. We Feed Raw was created to change that. Meals are made with real meat, nutrient-rich organs, and complete and balanced nutrition designed to help dogs truly thrive. No fillers, no mystery ingredients, no ultra-processing. Just real food delivered straight to the door and customized for each dog's needs. Many pet parents notice healthier digestion, shinier coats, better poops, and improved energy after making the switch. Because when dogs eat the way they're supposed to, you can often see the difference. Visit WeFeedRaw.com to get started and see today's best offer.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the states in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including live dealer, blackjack, and craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This episode was sponsored by We Feed Raw. Feeding dogs real food should not feel complicated. With We Feed Raw, it doesn't. Complete and balanced raw meals are customized for each dog's size, age, and activity level, then delivered right to the door. Just thaw, serve, and feed. No prep, no guesswork, no trying to figure out portions alone. Inside every meal is the highest quality meat, nutrient-rich organs, and premium nutrition designed to support better digestion, healthier skin and coats, and lasting energy. Real food, made practical for real life. Visit WeFeedRaw.com to get started and see today's best offer.
This is Hidden Tillers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Dream.
A man charged with allegedly killing seven women across nearly two decades on Long Island is now expected to walk into a courtroom and plead guilty. After almost 3 years of maintaining his innocence, after his defense fought to throw out DNA, split the case into separate trials, dismiss a murder charge for insufficient evidence, and point the finger at another convicted killer, Rex Huerman reportedly has decided to stop fighting. The question nobody can stop asking is, why now? And whether this was always inevitable or whether the prosecution boxed him into a corner that he couldn't think his way out of. Joining me to discuss this new development in this horrific case, Eric Faddis, former prosecutor, defense attorney, and of course my co-host Robin Drake, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program for the FBI. Eric, let's start here. A man stands before a court for nearly 3 years saying he did not do this, and then reportedly decides to plead guilty to seven murders from someone who's sat on both sides of this. Eric, what exactly is happening inside of those conversations between Rex and his attorney that seems to have brought us to this?
Sure, Tony. So, you know, from the outset with a client, you kind of have a strategic plan. You're kind of like, hey, we're going to explore these defenses. We're going to assert these potential constitutional violations. We're going to file these motions, and we're going to try to improve your legal position. But as the trial is looming and as it gets closer, reality starts to really kick in. And you, the client hopefully kind of appreciates their exposure at that juncture. And it's not uncommon for plea agreements to happen once trial is getting closer and people start to get freaked out.
So, Eric, what do you think he's pleading for on this one? I guess that's the huge question. You know, there's so many questions in this one, but, you know, inside New York, no death penalty. So it's not like the Koberger case where they're trying to leverage life, you know, for Koberger with a plea deal. So that's not in it. And the Son of Sam law, I researched it, but you probably know this better than me. So I'm curious about your take on whether this impacted or not. So Son of Sam law says that he cannot profit from any proceeds from his story, but his family can, according to the law. But it really depends, I guess, on what the judge says. Is that true? I mean, what do you think was the motivation?
Yeah, good question. There could be certain provisions included within a plea agreement whereby Herriman could not benefit in some form or fashion from selling his story to HBO or something like that. But yeah, what is his incentive? Because there's not death on the table, and usually the step down from that is life without the possibility of parole. I can't imagine that they're offering some sort of cap on prison time, like a cap of 40 years or something. But then again, you know, he might just kind of be done and ready to resolve this and sort of see the writing on the wall. But what are the benefits he might be trying to seek? Those are a little bit unclear. I don't know if it's prison placement. I don't know if it's
is that on the table, do you think? I know sometimes it is and sometimes it's not. Does the judge have the ability, or does the court have the ability to do prison placement?
It usually depends on the jurisdiction. Oftentimes not. Oftentimes right. It's up to the Bureau of Prisons. But there are certain things that can be written into a plea agreement that might be valuable to Rex. And so perhaps those are being negotiated presently.
I mean, even if they do have some sort of initial set of like, okay, we're going to send you off to this prison here. Isn't that ultimately always up to the Bureau of Prisons at the end of the day? I mean, like, okay, well, initially we'll send you here. Couldn't that just switch at any moment in time? Did they? I mean, maybe I'm completely off on this, but I don't believe that, you know, at some point in time, they'd be like, well, no, we can't move this prisoner because of the part of the plea agreement says he's going to be housed here indefinitely. Is that ever part of it?
You bring up a good point, because usually the court does not have jurisdiction over the Bureau of Prisons.
Yeah.
So it can't tell the prison what to do. It can make a recommendation.
Yeah.
It can say, hey, you know, it's the court's hope that the Bureau of Prisons, you know, accommodates what's listed in the plea agreement. But yeah, that's not set in stone, and it's not something that's really enforceable. It's really aspirational.
People roll the dice all the time when it comes to this sort of stuff, especially when it comes to like proffer agreements and things like that, where they're going to sit there and I'll give you your information that you need. And at the end of the day, I'm going to get this out of it. I'm not going to be prosecuted, or, you know, like we saw in the example of the au pair affair recently, where everyone thought, oh, well, she's just going to go back to her country of origin after that. Nope. Surprise. You get 10 years because it wasn't completely in stone. It was suggested. Maybe you'll get this, but at the end of the day, someone can still make a decision. It's a strong suggestion, and suggestions aren't necessarily set in stone. Do you think is this where he's at, where he's at this big of a disadvantage, where it's like, well, I'm going to hope that maybe I get a good suggestion here and have little to no control over anything? Is this how little control this man has left? And is this him trying to grasp at that last little hair of it? Pardon the pun.
You know, that very well could be. And Tony, as you and Robin know, there are other killings within this vicinity over the course of time for which Rex Herriman was suspected. Mm-hmm. And so perhaps there's something like, I'm just speculating, but if he, you know, cops to these 7 murders, if that's what the plea agreement looks like, then he could somehow have immunity from the additional suspected killings. You know, is that really a tangible benefit for him? I don't know, but it's an optics benefit. It may help his family in some form or fashion, may reduce potential restitution that he and his family would have to pay. So there are some bargaining chips, but they're very small.
You know, that'll be really interesting, Eric, because so if you're going down the road of what a typical, I don't know if you want to use the word typical, serial killer is, a lot of them are about that, you know, that large narcissistic, sociopathic grandiosity, always looking for more. You know, BTK is a great example. Grandiosity. Look at me. I'm the best. I did this. I really wonder if that was part of that calculation, that mind of his is like, all right, I'm not going to get away with this, but if I get a plea deal and I don't have to be charged with more, and I can try to get a suggestion of where I get to live, and my family gets to profit from the stories, if he feels compelled to put out more, if his driving focus is that grandiosity and being like the best at this, that might have played into it. I wonder. Just like he feels at liberty then to start trickling and exposing this, 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 and this. That's an interesting take on it. I wonder if that'll play into it. It'll be interesting. And also, what do you think the victims' families were thinking about this? Are that you think they're part of this discussion, this dialogue? And what do you think the impact of them is going to be from your experience?
Yeah, that ego piece could very well be a part of it. You know, maybe there's some subjective perverse benefit to him in saying that, hey, you caught me for these ones, but I know in my mind you didn't catch me for these other ones. Now, I'm not saying he necessarily did the other killings, but there's a strong suspicion. So, and then in terms of the victims' families, yeah, they by law typically have to be involved in the plea negotiation process, have to receive notice of it, have to have an opportunity to give their position on what the plea offer might be.
What do you think this is going to be?
With this many potential homicides, I can't fathom the prosecutor doing anything but life without the possibility of parole. And like I said, maybe there are some minor concessions that they could give him if he's willing to cop to that.
All right. Thanks.
We're trying to figure out, you know, what inspired him to take this route. We got the housing area, you know, maybe there's something with that. Do you think any of this comes down to his family? Do you think there's any emotional lever here that he has decided to pull that this somehow is to protect his family from going through this trial and all that they're going to be drugged through and all the extra exposure that they're going to face? Do you think it ended up being a conversation? Because apparently Asa's still been visiting him in prison. I mean, in the doc that was made more than a year ago, in the doc, she said that she called him his hero. I have no idea what Asa's opinion of him is today, and it could easily have changed within the course of a year. But I do wonder if there's something there of, he's doing this, you know, on the surface for them, but maybe at the end, it's more so it will prevent a trial and it will prevent them, maybe even her, I don't know, from possibly exposing Rex for other crimes. I mean, I'm wondering if there's something there, and I'm not accusing Asa of committing any crimes or anything of that nature, but it does seem like she is a bit of a vulnerability to him, because whether she knows it or not, she knows more about Rex than most people do. And she would be able to connect some dots and expose him probably in ways that she's not even aware that she'd be exposing him, but he is. And I'm wondering if there's something there, that there was a lever and it makes strategic sense for him. Maybe he was pressured into confessing by her to not be put through this. And he's rolling the dice going, my odds are better if it'll keep her shut up more and her less in the spotlight if we just kind of get this stuff, you know, pushed through and wrapped up.
Tony, that's kind of where my head went too, because like you said, the wife Asa has been kind of by his side, at least it's certainly early on, or at least supportive, and not something we often see in cases like this. And so, yeah, was it some sort of way to protect the family from this crucible of trial? You know, they've already had to deal with so much due to Rex's alleged actions, but you know, over time, 5-10 years from now, that can blow over. However, if there is a nationally publicized multi-week trial, multi-month trial potentially, that goes into the nauseating details of everything Rex did, and that could reflect on the family, maybe he wants to protect them from that. Maybe he's even vying for some kind of immunity for his family if there is any sort of suspicions in terms of knowledge or complicity or something else.
Yeah, I tell you, it's so interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, you have these incredibly psychopathic serial killers, which typically don't have empathy. They feign empathy so they can victimize people. And a lot of them are just pure actors. But then you see these behaviors like BTK. I know we keep bringing up because there's so much similarities here. You really wonder, is there a true bond with the human beings in his life, especially because, you know, to your point, Eric, the children. you know, maybe he doesn't want his daughter and his son exposed to the true horrors of everything he did because of that. I wonder if that did weigh on him at all when making that decision.
Yeah, very well could be. I mean, these people are human. Now, you know,
barely.
Some people use that term loosely, but they still have at least the theoretical capacity for those emotions.
You know, Robin, you say, you know, does he have a bond there with his kids and his wife or his ex-wife and all that? There's a bond, but what is that bond?
Is it a
lever that he can pull? Is it a transactional bond? Because a lot of people have bonds that on the surface, to the rest of us who don't have transactional bonds, and the bonds are there because we genuinely care and we have love and relationships that are built on those, you know, tenets of life and meaning that build true strong relationships. And there's people who have surface bonds that are built on transaction. And I think sometimes those folks who live in a world, in a life where their relationships are solely based on transaction, they don't even contemplate a deeper meaning. They think everybody works on transaction. And I'm wondering if that's part of it. If, like I was saying, if there is a transactional detail to that relationship with his family that somehow it works to his advantage to make this specific move. The other aspect of this that I come to wonder about is kind of the Koberger aspect of it. Why did Koberger do this at the very last minute too, at the 11th hour? I mean, basically the evidence was there. He was going to be crucified and the mask was going to not only slip, it was going to be ripped off and exposed, whether he liked it or not. And I'm wondering if there's an aspect to Rex Heuermann like that too, where, I mean, this was a very, very secretive man. At least nobody was digging deep enough for a majority of his existence. And I'm wondering if all those secrets that he spent decades trying to protect. I mean, a lot of them have already been revealed, but we're going to get in there deep if this went to trial. Every little aspect, every piece of dust, all of it is going to come out. And exposure to personalities like this, and it's hard to read him completely in his personality type, but if he is anywhere along the dark triad and has some of the narcissism going on there, that removal of the mask is like kryptonite. That's the worst possible thing. You really want them to feel shame or whatever it is that makes them feel bad, that would be the way to do it. And if you're going to have this done seven times over in a courtroom for seven different victims, I wonder if his give a shit just kind of got to a point of like, I can't take that. That's too much.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tony. I'm highly skeptical as well of him using, and he might even say it, or they'll put out a release like he's doing it for his family, but I seriously doubt he has the capacity to do it because, like you said, transactional. Yeah. And also with these serial killers, I mean, that imagery that they do for their own wacky sexual satisfaction of their trophies and how they align them and place them in woods or whatever they're doing, to have that no longer secret, it kind of bursts that bubble of theirs in their mind and that fantasy world they're living out. And so if it all gets exposed, he's left with nothing going to jail.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably more likely, like you and Eric were saying.
Yeah. And, you know, you look at briefly the like the Zodiac killer, for example, that person got off on the fact that they weren't going to be found out. You're not going to learn the details of what they're doing. You're not going to get into the inner workings of that. And when that is exposed, as Creative Chaosify said in the comments, that rips the control from Rex Heuermann, too. This could be a way that he still maintains control over those details.
I mean, that's the other aspect. I mean, this is, I'm sorry, Robin, it's a lever of control that he's trying to pull because he has none. And the extreme level of control that this guy operated under, I mean, it was almost comically bad where he like literally writing notes, like take the head, cut off the tat. Like if you're doing this, you really need notes to remind you like, oh shoot, I forgot I was supposed to take the head. Darn it.
Part of the fantasy. Yeah.
If only that was on notes. I'll put a post-it about it next time. And he does. There's another element to this. The judge still has to accept the plea. Eric, talk about this. This is like a legal end of this. What would it? What would make the judge reject it? Can he reject it? Is that a real possibility, or is that just a formality at this point?
Oh, it's definitely a real possibility. And I've seen countless pleas rejected by judges. You know, judges usually have substantial discretion in that, Tony. And it's kind of like, does the judge think this is fair? Does the judge think this is just under the circumstances? Now, oftentimes the judge will go along with a mutually agreed upon plea agreement, especially if the victim's families are in favor. But if for some reason, if the victim's families presented at court during the plea hearing and said, hey, this is not fair. It needs to be more serious in some fashion. The judge could say, hey, we've got, you know, a multiplicity of killings over the course of decades. And, you know, these concessions or whatever is built into the plea that might benefit Rex, the judge might not want that. So it could be rejected.
Yeah. Is that typically what sways the lever of influence on the judge, is families, or is it something else about whether to accept it or not accept it? You know, in your experience, what is the driving factor?
That the family's position plays a huge role, and you know, the judges want to do their best to do right by these victims' families. So that could absolutely that's usually the driving factor when a plea is rejected.
If he wants to plead guilty here, the judge can obviously reject the terms that they come to and say, nope, here's what it is. There are no concessions for him. It's exactly what I'm going to say it's going to be. Take it or leave it. And Rex could take it or leave it. He can't necessarily force a trial to take place if Rex is going to plead guilty. I guess only if Rex were to not agree to whatever the plea agreement would be what would force a trial, correct?
That's correct. If Rex didn't agree to it, he would still have his right to a trial, and he can always change his mind, even if there is an agreement in place.
Yeah.
You know, the things can change.
So many interesting angles to this. Just in your opinion, do you see a world here where the judge may reject whatever comes down the line? Number one, the prosecutors would, you know, be kind of rolling the dice a little bit if they're going to bring something to a judge that they think may be rejected. I'm going to think they're probably going to bring something that they're pretty confident in would be agreed upon to, wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. You always consider that as a prosecutor. You're like, hey, if I extend this plea offer, it's meaningless if the judge doesn't agree to it. And so you've got to have that forward thinking of like, hey, is the judge going to view this as acceptable? So I would anticipate that. But if there is any cap on prison, for example, even like 40 years, like up to 40 years in prison, I wouldn't be surprised if a judge looks at that and says, that's too lenient. Things can happen in prison. You know, sentences can be reduced. He might get out later. I'm not going to accept that. I wouldn't be surprised if a judge took such a position.
That's interesting. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we continue to break down Rex Hiraman his supposed plea deal that has not yet taken place, but we are in anticipation of. Substack and YouTube, the links are in the description to continue the conversation there. Investigators pulled a deleted Word document off Rex Hiraman's hard drive, allegedly created in around 2000, modified over several years with sections on supplies, problems, disposal sites, and targets. They matched his DNA to hairs found on and near multiple victims using a technology never before admitted in a New York courtroom. And they built the initial connection from a pizza crust he threw in the trash while being surveilled. When you lay down those pieces side by side, the question isn't whether the prosecution had a case, it's whether the defense ever even had a chance. Eric Faddis is with us to help break down where this case is at and where it's going. Prosecutors, they recovered that Word document from Hiraman's basement, that hard drive with the sections that allegedly outlined a lot of very specific things he tried to delete off of it as well. When evidence like that lands on a prosecutor's desk, what does that do to the trajectory of a case? And also, obviously, if it's on a prosecutor's desk, the defense knows that it's there too, and that this is going to be part of the evidence. I mean, how do you because you've seen both sides of this. How do you absorb that type of information? I mean, it seems like a slam dunk if you're the prosecutor, like, oh, he's got a document talking specifically about dismembering and doing these horrible things that were done to the victims. And then also, I have a client that has a document that talks about doing exactly what he's accused of doing. Not a good place to be in, Eric.
Yeah, you know, as a prosecutor, it's kind of like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and that's the golden ticket. I mean, that's going to take you to the promised land. That's essentially going to be construed as a confession. And confessions are some of the most compelling types of evidence. And so the weight of that alleged document cannot be overstated. Sure, there are ways to challenge it, but that is a tremendous problem for defense.
What would be a way you challenge it?
So a few things, especially with modern digital forensics, you know, you would look at who had access to the device from which that document was typed. You look at, IP addresses. Where was that document generated? If you can look back that far, it depends on, right, on a number of factors. And then also you can look at, you know, whether there had been any modification or manipulation since the prosecution got it. Digital forensics folks could look at that. And if you find something suspicious or curious in terms of modifications that might be made, sometimes you can sort of try to hang your hat on that and further, right, open that hole, widen that, and allege that, hey, there's some fishy stuff going on the other side. Are you sure this document's authentic in its entirety? There are ways to do it, but it'd be tough.
You know, I guess because if he wrote it and drafted it and they're able to show it in his secret hidey hole in his house where no one else had access, that was probably as damning as well.
That'd be a big problem. Yeah.
Very much so. Well, so whole genome sequencing has never been admitted as evidence in a New York trial before this case. The judge ruled that, yes, it can be and would be certainly part of this. Now it gets to be someone else's battle, I guess, in another case to be admitted at another trial. You know, the fact that it was going to be admitted here, I guess there was a long fight of this, you know, over a long period of time. Should it be added? Should it be allowed? Should it not? It was allowed. Obviously, if the trial never takes place here, how does that affect other cases going forward in New York where they're going to eventually use this? Is because it's newer technology. Can they look back on this case and go, see, it was going to be admitted. They never actually used it. Or is it make it, a hotter potato for another case that could be attempted to be argued in another courtroom?
It's most certainly a precedent that has been set in New York. In that sense, this case is kind of historic. Now, because it was set by a trial judge, it would not be binding on any other trial judge. It would not be binding on an appellate court judge or a Supreme Court judge. So it's binding, but it's what's called persuasive authority. And that happens all the time when there are disputes about expert testimony and the attorneys say, hey, look, this judge said it was sufficiently reliable to admit. Our case is very similar. New judge, you should admit this. And we, you know, as practicing attorneys, we have a cachet of orders from judges on issues like this that we then cite to in subsequent cases saying, hey, look, this judge thought it was good enough. You should think it's good enough, too.
You know, it's really interesting. From what I've researched, again, this whole genome sequencing thing is new to me, too, because they're just rolling it out, right? But from what I understand, and Tony, you probably know more about this than I do, they got it. They're used it because of the hairs, really, is because it's the first time they're actually able to extract the whole DNA sequence of someone from hair, and they couldn't do a typical DNA that's been done past cases. So just my thought experiment on this, as Huerman's learning about this whole DNA sequencing and seeing how sloppy he was with human hair for so long, maybe, again, part of that mental gyration he's doing about how to keep everything secret so he can keep it in his own little narcissistic head. He might have hairs all over that house or all over everything else that they'd be able to sequence, and he'd lose control. Again, I think it all comes back to that control. interesting.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's you know, I think some of these folks are kind of detached from reality and have this delusion that they're smarter than everybody else, including the law. And when these revelations come out, it can be a bit of a reality check.
I still think that's a huge part of this case and other cases of serial killers that span decades, really, where you start your criminal enterprise of murdering people when technology was saying I can behave this way. The technology and forensics involved, and they didn't.
There have been cases in the past where people have pled guilty and then have gotten out later because they found out somebody else did it and that they pled guilty for whatever reason they did at the time. You got seven murders here. So you could be, and I'm not saying this is, but I'm saying you could be looking at a scenario where he is responsible for like five of the seven or six of the seven. You could be having one where maybe he isn't. They've argued for a long time. The very first victim from 93 was not him, but they did find a hair on that one. And that's how they connected that one. It's not a ton of evidence that connects Rex Heerman to his very first victim all the way back in 1993. Let's just, for the sake of argument, without getting into the weeds too much, let's say something happens here and somebody comes forward, or there's undeniable evidence that one of these seven was not Rex Heerman, but for whatever reason he's pleading guilty because he is responsible truly for five of the seven or whatever it may be. Let's say that comes along in the coming years. What does that do to this? What does that do to this conviction or his guilty plea? Does that give him any sort of advantage down the line if he were to be like, you know what, maybe this was a bad idea. Maybe prison doesn't suit me so well. And then this person over here is truly responsible for this one that I pled to. And clearly it wasn't me. I've been saying that all along. I just did it to these. Is it where they can look back at it and go, well, yeah, you're still there for the other six and those all stand. Or does that blow the whole damn thing up and then have to make it be retried because they're all interconnected into one specific case, really? I know there's separate charges, but it's all in the one ruling.
Oh, that's a great question.
Totally. So the appellate courts usually favor finality. They don't like to reopen stuff. They don't like to send stuff back to the trial court, overturn convictions. They prefer to have this, you know, secured finality within these cases. So if that were to take place, I think that newly discovered exculpatory evidence is always a potential reason to withdraw a plea of guilty. And so would it be withdrawn? You know, it could be withdrawn with respect to that one specific killing. Could that cast further doubt on the other killings at a, you know, future appellate stage? It's at least possible. You know, Rex could say 5 years from now, if that were to happen, that, hey, actually, this other guy did this. When I copped to these pleas, I was not in my right mind. I had been in custody for a long time. My whole life had fallen apart and everything else. There's no certainty that all of the other convictions would be upheld, although an appellate court judge would, I believe, try to angle towards upholding the other convictions.
Now, is that something a defense attorney is going to counsel him on about a possibility of doing? Because again, these are questions I love throwing at Bob Mata too, is like, hey, or are they just going to do their job and grind it out and give him all these options? Or are they going to say to themselves, I'm not going to strategize that with him because he's a guilty douche?
You have to at least advise the client about and I've had that conversation, not those specific words, but
it's my technical words.
You know, you have to advise the client as to post-conviction consequences, potential post-conviction remedies. So you can speak in broad general terms about it, but at the same token, if you're the lawyer and your client's going in there to plead guilty, you have to have a reasonable belief that that is a valid plea. And so you can't kind of be like, hey, if something, you know, great happens later for your case and you can try to, you know, wiggle out of this or something. You kind of have to go in there saying, hey, we are taking responsibility and we is the defense. And that implicates the attorney.
Right. And that's my question. Sorry, Tony, was because I love Tony's thought experiment on that. That's really intriguing. But same time, though, is that something a defense attorney, I guess, is really going to do in those circumstances, given the fact that, like you said, hey, if we're pleading guilty, that means we're taking ownership of it all. A good point.
Yeah. Yeah. That's usually how it goes.
I mean, like in the Koberger situation, where part of the stipulation was there's no going back here. Once you're pleading, you're done. There's no appeals. You're not allowed to appeal. I would imagine, I mean, do you see a world here where the judge is going to accept whatever agreement this is, where he doesn't remove all possibilities of any sort of parole or any sort of appealing this in any way, shape, or form down the line, no matter what?
I think the prosecutor is going to be diligent in terms of divesting Rex Herrmann of any potential rights down the road to try to undo this. That being said, the judge doesn't have complete control over what happens in the future. And if in your hypothetical, it was proven that someone else did at least one of these killings, even if the judge said, hey, there's no resentencing, there's no reconsideration of the plea, there's not going to be any of that, you don't have that right, I think hypothetically, the Constitution would confer that right, and that would trump anything that is in the plea agreement or anything the judge order.
What do you think made him make this decision? Was it obviously just conjecture? Do you think it was him as an attorney sitting down, going, attorney having to come to Jesus meeting of like, look, we've lost everything that we've attempted to throw in front of this judge leading up to this trial, all of our motions have failed. All the things we try to get excluded are coming in. This is not going to go good. It's just not Rex. And if you want anything, if you want to save a little bit of whatever exists for your family, whatever little bit of dignity you have left, you should probably plea. Or do you think this was Rex going to his attorney and saying, I'm out. I think we should end this right now. I did it. I mean, how do you think that went down behind closed doors?
I've got to imagine it was sort of at the attorney's behest, because yeah. Rex Herrmann just doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who's going to like come, oh, hat in hand and saying, oh, you know what? I'm going to do the right thing and take responsibility. And yeah. I'm going to, you know, save these victims' families, all of this nightmarish stuff that's going to happen at trial. He doesn't strike me like that kind of guy. Could have been, but I just don't know. I think the attorney is more like, hey, dude, we've exhausted all of our potential outs. You don't have any other outs, man. If you want to save, like you said, some modicum of dignity, some very trivial minor concessions that we might be able to build into it, now's your chance to do it. And that's how I imagine it went down.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, at some point Eric, I mean, do you see this at all in clients of any age where, I mean, Rex isn't elderly, but, you know, he's getting more up there. You know, he's got a handful of good years left. Is there any correlation between an age at which someone says, screw it, I'm just whatever, I got 10, 20 years left. If I keep fighting this, I'm just going to be going in and out of courtrooms until I'm dead. Versus I'm going to make peace with this and I'm going to figure out what life is like behind bars. Do you ever see more backing down versus more fight depending on the age of the defendants?
Good question.
Oh, you'd be surprised. Totally. So, you know, you might have a 20-year-old client and let's say the evidence is significant and the offer is 5 years. Well, to a 20-year-old, 5 years, that's a quarter of their life. That seems like forever. They're yeah. like, hey, I'm going to throw away my life to do this. Let's fight this. Whereas if you're talking about someone in their 50s, 60s, 70s, you know, beyond, sometimes they do not have that. They have a different perspective.
Yeah.
In terms of time, in terms of headache, in terms of trauma. How shitty is this going to be for me? And is there a less painful alternative? I see that a lot more with folks who are up in age.
Interesting.
Except Donna Adelson.
Yeah. Well, Donna, I think, probably believes she will live forever. I think
yeah, I know, that nutter.
You get deep down with her, I think she might think she's a deity of some sort. Digging. Yeah. Everybody's thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube on this segment. The links are in the descriptions. Seven women have names attached to that guilty plea. But the families who've waited decades to hear those names spoken in a courtroom won't get a trial. They'll get a hearing, a sentencing date, and silence. where cross-examination should have been. And they're not the only ones left without answers. 11 sets of remains were found along that stretch of Long Island, and authorities have said they don't believe Hiraman is responsible for all of them. Shannon Gilbert's case remains its own unresolved chapter. The question hanging over all of this is whether a plea closes the book or just closes the chapter everyone was still reading. I think that's the other thought that I had come to my mind right away when I heard, oh, he's making a plea. There's a lot of remains that still have not been connected to anyone. And remains, it seems like every handful of months, we hear another one that gets connected to Rex. So the idea that Rex Hiraman may not ever end up in a courtroom for a murder trial, I don't think is completely impossible. It just may not be with these seven victims. Although who knows, if he is to be connected to one, he may do the same thing and plead guilty. In any way, shape, or form, does him pleading guilty to these seven hinder, slow down, prevent, or do anything to not connect him possibly with these other mysterious murders that have been out there? Is this in any way shielding him from any sort of connection out there? I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, I think I do, but I'm not sure. From a legal standpoint, what do you think?
So, yeah, two things, and they're sort of divergent. So from a legal standpoint, I think it makes it more likely that they'd be able to prosecute him, because once he has entered this plea for these seven killings, there's a concept called modus operandi. Like he took similar actions in other circumstances that have distinct characteristics that can potentially tie him to these other things. So it makes it more likely he did that, and past acts, including prior homicide convictions, can be used to prosecute other homicides for which he has not yet been convicted. On the other hand, practically speaking, my concern is the authorities are going to be like, hey, we gave it our best shot. We got him on seven. You know, this has been decades in the making. We're going to close this chapter. We've got other priorities to work on. And that is really the tragedy for these families. Can you imagine how it would feel if like you lost your loved one years ago, had no answers, and then they finally find a guy who seems like he might be suspected in it, and they get him on the other stuff, but not on your loved one's case? Like, it'd be devastating.
So here's what could be good, though. You know, if we have great investigators, which I believe their department has great investigators, like, so here's my mindset. As soon as you rolled that out, Tony, the first thing going through my mind, excited. I got excited because, like, oh my God, I can go talk to this guy finally. He's not in the middle of a trial. You know, the reins are off. I can go interview him. I can talk to him. I get access to all the data, all the information, all the leads. And so if you do have some hungry investigators that are trying to close these cold cases, trying to figure them out, especially, I can only imagine now, you have a lot of families of these unsolved deaths and unsolved missing people that have been hounding that department and other departments, that now that you are once the plea is accepted and sentencing is done, they will have access to him if he's willing to have the access and have those dialogues. I think there's a lot of potential there. Again, I'm always glass half full on these things.
Yeah, it's an important point.
I guess my concern would be this. Everybody's human. And we know sometimes we've seen cases where you have somebody that's in prison for their stack of murders, and there's these unsolved cold cases out here. And then if you go and try and tack it onto the guy who's already in there, who's already admitted to all these, sometimes they just, yep, I did it. I'll take that one too, whether or not it was actually true or not. Then you actually don't get to the bottom of who was behind the actual murders. Is that, I mean, are we looking at that? I mean, being a real risky kind of possibility there, where once you do get him behind bars, are we going to see a bunch more get tacked onto him, with the prosecutors hoping that, you know, maybe he'll just admit to those two and we can just kind of move along down the line and get these off of my list of active cases that we're investigating and just, you know, shove it down the line, you know, or is this more glass half full? Does this take us into a territory where maybe we can actually find the answers to some of these, and maybe they do lead us to Hiraman? But it is kind of one of those things where you're taking humans and letting them be humans, and humans aren't always the most accurate creatures.
I would say if you're asking him, I'm sorry, Eric, you know, before you go, I would think if you're asking him where the bodies, like not just, you know, like do missing people as well. So that's like singular information I think you could lead to potentially anyway. So sorry, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, no, I hear you that there's some potential there for further justice. There's some potential there for the absence of justice, the facade of justice, something that is hollow, whereby Rex just says, yeah, whatever, that was me. And you know, how satisfying is that to a victim's family? Sure, it gets a conviction, you know, marked up on the docket, but how meaningful is that if we can't place faith in it?
Is this something where once they got him in the corner, he's obsessed with control? If he is responsible for more murders, and I believe he is, I think a lot of people do. I don't think he went silent from 93 to 2000. I think there's plenty more out there. Can he now use, basically, he's just kind of, okay, I'm locked in the stadium now. Here's the goalposts, and here's where they're at. He can't get out, but he can choose where he sits. And I'm wondering if that's something he's going to use to his advantage of, oh, you want to know where the other bodies are? You want to get me on this one? Oh, that's great. But here's what I want from behind bars to tell you where they are. I want this in my cell. I don't want a roommate. I don't want, you know, I mean, how much, I guess the question is, how much leverage does an inmate have behind bars if then they are convicted or accused of other crimes? And he says, yep, did those too. You want to find out where the bodies are? I want this. Is that something he can use? Is that a lever he can pull once he is behind bars?
Good question.
I think we need to look no further than Ghislaine Maxwell's case. She was convicted of some horrendous human trafficking crimes. And, you know, then when she started purportedly working with the government, so not clear exactly what that looked like, but she got transferred to a pretty nice kind of white collar prison, and so there are bargaining chips that those folks have on the inside, and this could in some perverse way allow them to retain some modicum of control, and he keeps being the puppet master back there. That would be a miscarriage of justice.
You know, Eric, when you said that, the first thing that went through my mind when I saw this potential plea was, oh my God, he's been behind bars long enough that he said, I figured this out. I got it. Let me do this so I maintain that control. I really think that's what a lot of this was. He figured out the system inside, saw that it's survivable for him, that what he wants to do for his last few years of life, and he knew if he could actually use this lever of manipulation or this one, using what he could hold in the bank, it actually thought he could set himself up pretty good for that. That was what went through my mind.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like he's come to the acceptance of he's never going to be on the outside world anymore. So how can I make my inside world as good as it can be? And we're all looking at it as, oh, he's scratching at the doors trying to get back to the outside world. No, I don't think he is. I think he's pretty good where he's at. And I think he's trying to, you know, do what he always does, control the environment around him. And I wonder if this is part of that play. Is there anything that a judge could do going into his sentencing here, if he does plea and if he accepts it and all these levers do fall the way we think they're going to fall, where any of that could be prevented? Can a judge be proactive in this sort of shit to prevent somebody from pulling the Ghislaine Maxwell card of like, you can do all you can make your claims of this and do all you want, but you know what? At the end of the day, none of it's going to matter because we've already said to you, no, I mean, and it's a shame that maybe we're not going to find out where these bodies are, but you are not going to take advantage of the system to your dying day with what little levers you have left.
Even the most righteous judge has very limited control over those things. For example, the judge doesn't have jurisdiction over the Bureau of Prisons, and Rex could make a deal with a warden or whatever that never even sees the judge's desk. In addition to that, the judge doesn't have jurisdiction over law enforcement. So Rex could talk with detectives, he could talk with prosecutors, and he could bargain for himself some kind of, you know, little benefits here and there over which the judge has zero control. So the judge can put some aspirational orders into different rulings. But at the end of the day, the judge can't say, you know, hey, don't transfer him to this nicer facility. The judge can't do that.
Yeah, you can really see the thought experiment maybe going through Rex's head on this, where the only thing he's going to be left with when he is behind bars and he came to that conclusion, there's no getting out of this. So what does he have left? The only currency he can bring behind bars with him, he probably witnessed this with other people, is information. And as soon as that information is gone, it's no longer currency he can leverage for the things he wants. And so I think he pled because he's going to maintain as much of that control, that information he has, so he can actually decide what he wants to spend it on for life.
Yeah, no, I feel you.
One more question, and in no way am I accusing Asa of having knowledge of any of this or her kids or anything. She may be just as much of a victim as everybody else, or she may be completely clueless. No one can argue, like, maybe you should have been more aware of what was going on around you and your family and your home. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. But there's still a lot of people who look at this, the dynamics of this relationship, and go, you didn't know anything? And there's a difference between, you know, your husband's weird and you suspect he's up to weird shit, but you don't know what it is. That may be all this is. But there's some folks who do think that she might have been more involved or had more knowledge of what was going on. And I'm not saying that she did. I guess I'm just asking this from a legal perspective of, is there any exposure that she still faces or now faces with him pleading guilty to this? If he's the one who did this, then we know flat, then that basically says, okay, this shit was going on in this house where she lived for all of those years. Does that put any sort of weight into any investigation further into her, or would they have already, do you think they've already exhausted those roads and came up to the conclusion of, she's got nothing to do with any of this, and so we're not going to go after her? I mean, we've seen cases where they kind of pick family member off by family member, Adelson's being one of them. I'm just wondering, you know, and again, I'm not accusing her. I'm not saying she did. I personally think she was just ignorant on the whole damn thing and told herself whatever she told herself to get by and ignorance. Yeah, I really, that's my personal feeling on it after watching this case for 3 years. But I don't know the answer for sure. Only a few people do. What's your thoughts there?
Yeah, you know, and like you, Tony, I have zero evidence that the wife had any knowledge or involvement. But just talking, you know, hypothetically, when you've got 7 killings, you've got these brutal murders going on, law enforcement is not usually inclined to just give some peripheral actor a pass. You know, if they were to uncover evidence tying her to some sort of criminal action and association with these murders, I think they would be remiss not to at least further investigate that and see if there's any provable crimes there.
Wouldn't they already be there, though, by now?
Yeah, it's my question, too. Would it have popped up already or no?
You know, we've been doing this for several years with Rex Herrmann. I would anticipate that, yes. And in fact, the prosecutors would be smart to, if they did have such evidence, use that as further leverage, saying, hey, you know, your wife, we believe, may have committed these crimes. That's going to be really a huge bummer for her. And also, we might call her to testify against you in your trial. So I imagine they would have already taken measures in furtherance of that if they had the goods.
What's the likelihood that they could actually, that Rex and his team could actually make her immunity part of that plea deal? And
they
would accept it.
Yeah, you know, that's usually pretty, it's uncommon, because usually an immunity deal is only for the defendant, for the party. But, you know, could theoretically a person broker immunity for somebody else? I don't know of any legal authority prohibiting it. And I think a defense attorney could get creative.
That's what I was just starting to wonder about too, Robin, when I was asking that question.
I'm reading your mind.
Yes. I do wonder about that. Like, could they have come to him and said, look, you know, you're going down for this. And you know what? We're going to take your wife and maybe your daughter too. Not because they were out there doing this with you, but because we can prove probably to a jury that maybe they did, maybe they did, that they had some sort of knowledge of this. Or we're at least going to, maybe they're scaring Rex. So if we think we have enough and we're going to throw this out there, and or we can make them immune. They can be witnesses for the state. But unless you go down this road, we're not going to grant that immunity, and we could prosecute them, and we could put them behind bars. So what is it, Rex? Would you like to have your wife and your daughter go to prison for the foreseeable future while you rot in a cell, or would you like to just go rot yourself?
But remember, we think it's not because he likes them or cares for them.
Yeah.
It's because of the exposure he'd have from them being on trial. I want to go down, keep going on the road of him being an ass. Not a caring individual. Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
You better believe that those conversations happen oftentimes behind closed doors between prosecutors and defense attorneys. You know, you're trying to assess the your client's exposure. You're trying to assess what horrible things could happen if we don't take this plea. And the prosecutors are not shy about saying, could there be additional charges? Could there be additional defendants? Could all of this stuff happen? It could. But hey, how about let's just, you know, cop to it now, and we'll avoid that huge nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, could and would and stick are very different things. I mean that's the thing. But if you present it as this could happen, and you know, with the right jury, it could. Even if there's really not enough to truly, because again, I don't think that they had knowledge. I mean, maybe retrospectively, they may look back and go, oh, it was weird what happened on that Tuesday, but I never really saw it from that perspective until now. I mean, there may be some of that, but I don't think they were sitting there like, oh, look what Dad has in the document today. Oh, why that tattoo, Dad? Why are you cutting that one off? I don't think it was like that by any means. But if you can put that in front, and they must know, they might know more. They might be able to connect some of your actions to some of these other crimes. I do wonder. I really do wonder. I think that might be the inspiration lever that got pulled right there.
They would, and final note on that, Tony, too, because what they would know, so even if they weren't witting, like it looks like they're not witting, but they know the pattern, his behavior for all those years, because remember, they were groomed into complacency. But they have a pattern of his behavior of what he did and what he did with them when he's doing these killings. And so they could actually then, if they went over, to continue to interview her, they could actually uncover even more of his secrets based on not her knowledge of what he did, but the knowledge of his patterns of behavior that they can then superimpose on all these other cases. So that's why I think the exposure is that the leakage she could have inadvertently towards other things he had done is what they could get.
Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't believe Rex has a public defender, does he? I mean, isn't this a paid for defender, or am I wrong on that? I could be wrong.
Give me one second.
I'm not sure. If it is a private defense attorney, then the financial piece could absolutely be playing a role, but I'll have to check my notes on that.
Yeah, because that would also then affect, because I believe that she got the divorce to protect assets and things of that nature. But the money is somewhere. I mean, if it's not a public defender, he's getting paid somehow, and that money could either go to Asa and the children existing or to defending. Yeah, another interesting lever. Yeah.
Looks like court appointed.
It is court appointed. Okay. Well.
Yep.
Oh, there we go. That answers that question.
Represented by court appointed assigned counsel. Yeah. Michael Brown from Islip.
Okay. I didn't know Michael was. Okay. I didn't know. Well, that answers that. But the other one seemed to stick. I don't know. Very interesting. Would we ever know the answer to that question, Eric? Once this all comes out and the plea deal is finalized, would we ever know if that was a lever that was pulled to motivate him to do this?
Unless it is written into the plea, probably not, and typically not. You know, those conversations can be of a threatening nature between the attorneys, and those don't necessarily see the light of day. Sometimes that's a phone call. Sometimes that's a meeting in a hallway.
Yeah, interesting. Well, there you go. Such a fascinating case. We'll see where it plays out. I still feel like there's going to be more twists and turns. I don't think this is the end of Rex Hiraman once he's behind bars, just like so many of these serial killers seem to be that way. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, as always, thank you so much for joining us and giving us your insight into this case. Robin Drake, retired FBI special agency for the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. His book, latest one, It's Not All About Me, available wherever you get your books. Go and check it out. You, please press subscribe wherever you are listening or watching us, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, so you don't miss any of our reporting and conversations on these cases. And give us your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'll continue the conversation right there. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here. And you know what's more American than America's 250th birthday? Supporting American-owned companies like SpinQuest, America's number one social casino with over 1,000 games like Live Dealer Blackjack and Craps. They're offering new users a $30 coin package for just $10. Go to SpinQuest.com and sign up today.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's up, everybody? It's Bretzky, and America is turning 250. And I can't think of a better way to celebrate that than playing on an American-owned social casino, SpinQuest.com. With all of your favorite games, live craps, bubble craps, live blackjack, there's no better place to play for free and win real cash prizes. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Ugh, I have had no luck lately. Wait, lady luck?
Bretzky, I got you. I've had so much luck on SpinQuest.com. They have all of my favorite games, slot games, live blackjack craps, and bubble craps. You can even get a $30 coin pack for just 10 bucks.
10 bucks for 30? I'm headed over to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hanging out at the pool is great. Relaxing and playing Vegas-style games on my phone at the same time. Drink in one hand and a blackjack in the other. It's all at SpinQuest. Over 1,000 games, including your favorite slots and table games. Be cool with this summer special. New players get $30 coin packs for 10 at SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
What's going on, everyone? It's Bluff here, and we're driving through the States in the Bluffmobile, and the best thing that we can do is play our favorite casino-style games on SpinQuest. They have over 1,000 games, including Live Dealer, Blackjack, and Craps, with tons of slots and unlimited options. You can get a $30 coin pack for just $10 for new users. Sign up today. Go to SpinQuest.com right now.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That two-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps, with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.